she wanted to live at any price. She was somebody who simply didn't, for whom extinction, death, whatever you want to call it, was unbearable. And so she was going to fight for every breath.
That's David Reif talking about his mother, Susan Sontag. She was one of America's most celebrated intellectuals, a woman known for her fierce intelligence and uncompromising critical stance. A woman who, as it turned out, could not handle one of the most basic facts of life: that it ends. A few years ago, Susan Sontag developed a lethal form of blood cancer. She tried everything, including a bone marrow transplant. And right up to the end, she refused to let anyone tell her she was dying. Now, her son, David Reif, has written an account of his mother's last days. "Swimming in a Sea of Death" is the story of how he tried to do the right thing for her, while also being true to himself. Reif told Steve Paulson that Sontag fought her illness to the very end.
Half the subject of my book is that, is what is it when somebody, no matter how terrible the odds, thinks that extinction is so unbearable that you must fight, and what does that mean when we are all going to have to die?
It is worth pointing out that twice before, your mother had cancer and survived. And one time was, I mean, the odds were incredibly stacked against her.
They were. She had survived a cancer about which her own doctors, this was in the mid-70s, a time when American physicians tended to lie to their patients and tell family members something closer to the truth. And I was told by her doctors that she would die quite soon. She had a stage 4 breast cancer that had spread into the lymph system. So you're right. She had a basis for thinking that when a doctor said it was hopeless, it wasn't necessarily so.
And yet it seemed to be clear, at least the way you write about this, that it pretty much was hopeless in this case. At least that's what you were being told by the doctors, but I had the impression that that's not what your mother wanted to hear.
Well, a cancer for which there's no treatment, where you're talking about either total cure or death, is a much harder cancer than, say, cancers that could be treated by radiation or chemotherapy, where maybe you're not going to live 10 years, but say you might live 3. You might get some remission. This is a roll of the dice. And my mother was 71, and this bone marrow transplant is harder and harder to do successfully the older you get. So, you know, the chances were indeed very stacked against her. But she didn't want to hear it. I mean, again, that's sort of the subject of this book, which is as much as anything a book of questions. It's what do you, as the person who's close to someone who wants to live at any price, do when you think maybe this fight isn't worth it, or wherein you, I mean, do you lie? Do you insist on telling the truth when it's perfectly clear that the person doesn't want to know the truth, which was certainly true of my mother?
Even though on the surface she did say, "Don't lie to me," but every indication was she didn't want to hear the truth, and she wanted it both ways.
Well, she did. She just wanted to be lied to. I mean, she didn't want to be lied to. It's almost a stupid way of me to express it. She wanted to live, and she hoped, I think, that I and other people in her life would give her reason to hope. But when the bone marrow transplant really started to go wrong, which was pretty soon after it took place, I didn't think she was going to make it. And yet every signal she was giving me was, you know, give me hope, help me believe I might make it. And in the end, I chose to do that. I thought, well, the first and most important thing I thought was, it's her death, not mine.
Was that hard for you, though? I mean, you weren't telling her the truth. I mean, did that take a toll on you?
Yeah, I think it probably did. Well, it exacted a tremendous price on a certain level in that I never got to say goodbye. I mean, whether people really have these things or not, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to romanticize the end of life. I mean, but we never had the kinds of conversations where, I suppose, if I'd had my druthers, I would have liked to have had with her conversations about the past. I would have liked to have said certain things to her, including just things, you know, we had a complicated relationship. There were very good times and very bad times between us. I would have liked to have gone beyond those, at least before she left us. But that's impossible if you decide not to acknowledge the fact of dying. So sure, I mean, that's the price I paid.
The way you write about this, it wasn't just that she desperately wanted to live. She was also terrified of dying. I mean, there was a kind of existential dread there.
There was, yeah. I think lots of people are really terrified of dying. I've also met lots of people who aren't, but she was one of the ones to whom it was just terrible news. I mean, one of the things I quote in the book is a famous poem of the British poet Philip Larkin, which is called Obad, which is a poem of terror about no longer existing. And I know there are other people for whom dying is okay, and of course, I think some people of faith, at least, find it easier.
Yeah, let me follow up on that, because your mother was an atheist. She refused to accept any consolation in the hope that there might be an afterlife. I'm wondering how much of that played into this dread.
Well, I'm an atheist, too, so if anything, more militant than my mother. So I'm not sure I'm the right person to answer that question. I will say that I think it would have been grotesque of my mother to have become a person of faith purely in the interests of consoling herself. I mean, surely that would have been the most terrible therapeutic use of faith and a sort of disgrace in terms of faith. I mean, if you don't believe, you shouldn't suddenly start believing because it suits you. I mean, you believe for other reasons.
But it does raise the question, without the consolation of religion, does the prospect of dying necessarily lead to dread? How much of that contributed, do you think, towards your mother's panic?
Well, it sure doesn't help. I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer to that. There are certainly religious traditions that don't believe in an afterlife. So I don't think one could just take the Christian or the Islamic model and say, well, you know, those visions, which are visions of a personal afterlife, are what religious faith is. I mean, if you look at Buddhism, if you look at Judaism, both of those have no afterlife in that sense. So I'm not sure it's faith versus atheism is all I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Can you tell me about the last days?
Everything that could go wrong did go wrong after the transplant. So she's really suffered in a way like somebody being tortured. I mean, she, by the end, couldn't even roll over unassisted. Anyway, once she died, I asked the other people to leave the room, and I spent some minutes, and I really looked. I took her shirt off, to be blunt. And she was just a sore. The body was just a sore from the inside of her mouth to her toes. So the suffering was extraordinary. But the actual death was comparatively easy in the sense that she wasn't in pain, as far as we could tell. And then she sort of, in the last days, kind of withdrew. And when she spoke about the distant past, about her parents, about people she was involved with 30 years before. She really wasn't focused on the present or any of us. And then she lapsed into a kind of somnolence and she died.
Now, these days, there's a lot of talk about what's often called a good death, and usually this means someone who accepts dying and stops fighting it. There's a certain kind of resignation, and then often, the way people talk about this, there's a certain grace that can follow. Not only is there a sense of inner peace, but the dying person often has very meaningful and profound conversations with friends and family who are close. And to use a word that you scorn in your book, there is some closure. I guess by contrast, it would seem that your mother had anything but a good death. Do you see it that way?
No, I think that's something people say to console themselves. I don't believe a word of what you just said. I don't mean you're necessarily, you, I don't know whether you believe it or not, but I mean, I know this argument very well. I think that argument does a real disservice to human variety. I mean, people are very different. They're very different in their lives and they're very different in their deaths. And the idea that there's one good death, as it were, one good death fits all, seems to me a kind of credible reductiveness of what human beings are all about. I mean, it's like saying all human beings should be cheerful. Well, I don't think I don't know that being a cheerful person is better than being a melancholy person. People have different temperaments. I think when you say grace, I think it lets the family members off the hook. They don't have to feel so bad that the person is going. That seems to be more germane to that kind of stereotypical good death that people talk about today than anything else. So I'm afraid I don't buy it.
It also sounds like you're saying that this is the way your mother had to die. Given who she was, there was no other way.
Well, what I'm saying is that because people are so very different, the right way for one person to die may not be the right way for another person to die, or the necessary way. And she was somebody who desperately didn't want to die. So why should she have made our lives easier by going gracefully?
David Reif talking with Steve Paulson about his memoir, Swimming in a Sea of Death. You can read a print version of this interview on Salon Magazine. Visit our website for links and more information. It's at ttbook.org.